Chapter 10. About midday on the 3rd of May, a friend crossing the lounge of the hotel said casually, "There's been some kind of trouble at the telephone exchange, I hear." For some reason, I paid no attention to it at the time. That afternoon, between 3 and 4, I was halfway down the Ramblas when I heard several rifle shots behind me. I turned round and saw some youths with rifles in their hands and the red and black handkerchiefs of the anarchists round their throats, edging up a side street that ran off the Ramblas northward. They were evidently exchanging shots with someone in a tall, octagonal tower, a church, I think, that commanded the side street. I thought instantly, it's started. But I thought it without any very great feeling of surprise. For days past, everyone had been expecting it to start at any moment. I realised that I must get back to the hotel at once and see if my wife was all right. But the knot of anarchists round the opening of the side street were motioning the people back and shouting to them not to cross the line of fire. More shots rang out. The bullets from the tower were flying across the street, and a crowd of panic-stricken people were rushing down the Ramblas away from the firing. Up and down the street you could hear snap, snap, snap as the shopkeepers slammed the steel shutters over their windows. I saw two popular army officers retreating cautiously from tree to tree, with their hands on their revolvers. In front of me, the crowd was surging into the metro station in the middle of the Ramblas to take cover. I immediately decided not to follow them. It might mean being trapped underground for hours. At this moment, an American doctor who had been with us at the front ran up to me and grabbed me by the arm. He was greatly excited. "Come on, we must get down to the Hotel Falcon." The Hotel Falcon was a sort of boarding house maintained by the Poom and used chiefly by militiamen on leave. "The Poom chaps will be meeting there. The trouble's starting. We must hang together." "But what the devil is it all about?" I said. The doctor was hauling me along by the arm. He was too excited to give a very clear statement. It appeared that he had been in the Plaza de Catalunya when several lorry loads of armed civil guards had driven up to the telephone exchange, which was operated mainly by CNT workers, and made a sudden assault upon it. Then some anarchists had arrived, and there had been a general affray. I gathered that the trouble earlier in the day had been a demand by the government to hand over the telephone exchange, which, of course, was refused. As we moved down the street, a lorry raced past us from the opposite direction. It was full of anarchists with rifles in their hands. In front, a ragged youth was lying on a pile of mattresses behind a light machine gun. When we got to the Hotel Falcon, which was at the bottom of the Ramblas, a crowd of people was seething in the entrance hall. There was a great confusion. Nobody seemed to know what we were expected to do, and nobody was armed, except the handful of shock troopers who usually acted as guards for the building. I went across to the Comité Local of the Poom, which was almost opposite. Upstairs, in the room where militiamen normally went to draw their pay, another crowd was seething. A tall, pale, rather handsome man of about 30, in civilian clothes, was trying to restore order and handing out belts and cartridge boxes from a pile in the corner. There seemed to be no rifles as yet. The doctor had disappeared. I believe there had already been casualties and a call for doctors, but another Englishman had arrived. Presently, from an inner office, the tall man and some others began bringing out armfuls of rifles and handing them round. The other Englishman and myself, as foreigners, were slightly under suspicion, and at first nobody would give us a rifle. Then a militiaman, whom I had known at the front, arrived and recognised me, after which we were given rifles and a few clips of cartridges, somewhat grudgingly. There was a sound of firing in the distance, and the streets were completely empty of people. Everyone said that it was impossible to go up the Ramblas. The civil guards had seized buildings in commanding positions and were letting fly at everyone who passed. I would have risked it and gone back to the hotel, but there was a vague idea floating round that the Comité Local was likely to be attacked at any moment, and we had better stand by. All over the building, on the stairs and on the pavement outside, small knots of people were standing and talking excitedly. No one seemed to have a very clear idea of what was happening. All I could gather was that the civil guards had attacked the telephone exchange and seized various strategic spots that commanded other buildings belonging to the workers. There was a general impression that the civil guards were after the CNT and the working class generally. It was noticeable that, at this stage, no one seemed to put the blame on the government. The poorer classes in Barcelona looked upon the civil guards as something rather resembling the black and tans, and it seemed to be taken for granted that they had started this attack on their own initiative. Once I'd heard how things stood, I felt easier in my mind. The issue was clear enough. On one side the CNT, on the other side the police. I have no particular love for the idealized worker, as he appears in the bourgeois communist mind, but when I see an actual flesh-and-blood worker in conflict with his natural enemy, the policeman, I do not have to ask myself which side I am on. A long time passed, and nothing seemed to be happening at our end of the town. It didn't occur to me that I could ring up the hotel and find out whether my wife was all right. I took it for granted that the telephone exchange would have stopped working, though, as a matter of fact, it was only out of action for a couple of hours. There seemed to be about 300 people in the two buildings. Predominantly, they were people of the poorest class, from the back streets down by the quays. There was a number of women among them, some of them carrying babies, and a crowd of little ragged boys. I fancy that many of them had no notion what was happening and had simply fled into the Poom buildings for protection. There was also a number of militiamen on leave and a sprinkling of foreigners. As far as I could estimate, there were only about 60 rifles between the lot of us. The office upstairs was ceaselessly besieged by a crowd of people who were demanding rifles and being told that there were none left. The younger militia boys, who seemed to regard the whole affair as a kind of picnic, were prowling round and trying to wheedle or steal rifles from anyone who had them. It was not long before one of them got my rifle away from me by a clever dodge and immediately made himself scarce. So I was unarmed again, except for my tiny automatic pistol, for which I had only one clip of cartridges. It grew dark, I was getting hungry, and seemingly there was no food in the Falcon. My friend and I slipped out to his hotel, which was not far away, to get some dinner. The streets were utterly dark and silent, not a soul stirring, steel shutters drawn over all the shop windows, but no barricades built yet. There was a great fuss before they would let us into the hotel, which was locked and barred. When we got back, I learned that the telephone exchange was working, and went to the telephone in the office upstairs to ring up my wife. Characteristically, there was no telephone directory in the building, and I didn't know the number of the Hotel Continental. After a searching from room to room for about an hour, I came upon a guidebook which gave me the number. I could not make contact with my wife, but I managed to get hold of John McNair, the ILP representative in Barcelona. He told me that all was well, nobody had been shot, and asked me if we were all right at the Comité Local. I said that we should be all right if we had some cigarettes. I only meant this as a joke. Nevertheless, half an hour later, McNair appeared with two packets of Lucky Strikes. He had braved the pitch-dark streets, roamed by anarchist patrols who had twice stopped him at the pistol's point and examined his papers. I shall not forget this small act of heroism. We were very glad of the cigarettes. They had placed armed guards at most of the windows, and in the street below a little group of shop troopers were stopping and questioning the few passers-by. An anarchist patrol car drove up, bristling with weapons. Beside the driver, a beautiful, dark-haired girl of about 18 was nursing a submachine gun across her knees. I spent a lot of time wandering about the building, a great rambling place of which it was impossible to learn the geography. Everywhere was the usual litter, the broken furniture and torn paper that seemed to be the inevitable products of revolution. All over the place, people were sleeping. On a broken sofa in a passage, two poor women from the quayside were peacefully snoring. The place had been a cabaret theatre before the Poom took it over. There were raised stages in several of the rooms. On one of them was a desolate grand piano. Finally, I discovered what I was looking for. The armoury. I didn't know how this affair was going to turn out, and I badly wanted a weapon. I had heard it said so often that all the rival parties, PSUC, POUM and the CNT-FAI alike, were hoarding arms in Barcelona, that I could not believe that two of the principal Poom buildings contained only the 50 or 60 rifles that I had seen. The room which acted as an armoury was unguarded and had a flimsy door. Another Englishman and myself had no difficulty in prizing it open. When we got inside, we found that what they had told us was true. There were no more weapons. All we found there were about 2 dozen small-bore rifles of an obsolete pattern and a few shotguns, with no cartridges for any of them. I went up to the office and asked if they had any spare pistol ammunition. They had none. There were a few boxes of bombs, however, which one of the anarchist patrol cars had brought us. I put a couple in one of my cartridge boxes. They were a crude type of bomb, ignited by rubbing a sort of match at the top, and very liable to go off of their own accord. People were sprawling asleep all over the floor. In one room, a baby was crying, crying ceaselessly. Though this was May, the night was getting cold. On one of the cabaret stages, the curtains were still up. So I ripped a curtain down with my knife, rolled myself up in it, and had a few hours' sleep. My sleep was disturbed, I remember, by the thought of those beastly bombs, which might blow me into the air if I rolled on them too vigorously. At 3 in the morning, the tall, handsome man who seemed to be in command woke me up, gave me a rifle, and put me on guard at one of the windows. He told me that Salas, the chief of police responsible for the attack on the telephone exchange, had been placed under arrest. Actually, as we learned later, he had only been deprived of his post. Nevertheless, the news confirmed the general impression that the civil guards had acted without orders. As soon as it was dawn, the people downstairs began building two barricades, one outside the Comité Local and the other outside the Hotel Falcon. The Barcelona streets are paved with square cobbles, easily built up into a wall, and under the cobbles is a kind of shingle that is good for filling sandbags. The building of those barricades was a strange and wonderful sight. I would have given something to be able to photograph it. With the kind of passionate energy that Spaniards display when they have definitely decided to begin upon any job of work, long lines of men, women, and quite small children were tearing up the cobblestones, hauling them along in a handcart that had been found somewhere, and staggering to and fro under heavy sacks of sand. In the doorway of the Comité Local, a German-Jewish girl, in a pair of militiaman's trousers whose knee buttons just reached her ankles, was watching with a smile. In a couple of hours, the barricades were head high, with riflemen posted at the loopholes, and behind one barricade a fire was burning and men were frying eggs. They had taken my rifle away again, and there seemed to be nothing that one could usefully do. Another Englishman and myself decided to go back to the Hotel Continental. There was a lot of firing in the distance, but seemingly none in the Ramblas. On the way up, we looked in at the food market. A very few stalls had opened. They were besieged by a crowd of people from the working-class quarters south of the Ramblas. Just as we got there, there was a heavy crash of rifle fire outside, some panes of glass in the roof were shivered, and the crowd went flying for the back exits. A few stalls remained open, however. We managed to get a cup of coffee each and buy a wedge of goat's milk cheese, which I tucked in beside my bombs. A few days later, I was very glad of that cheese. At the street corner where I had seen the anarchists begin firing the day before, a barricade was now standing. The man behind it, I was on the other side of the street, shouted to me to be careful. The civil guards in the church tower were firing indiscriminately at everyone who passed. I paused and then crossed the opening at a run. Sure enough, a bullet cracked past me, uncomfortably close. When I neared the Poom Executive Building, still on the other side of the road, there were fresh shouts of warning from some shock troopers standing in the doorway, shouts which, at the moment, I did not understand. There were trees and a newspaper kiosk between myself and the building. Streets of this type in Spain have a broad walk running down the middle, and I could not see what they were pointing at. I went up to the Continental, made sure that all was well, washed my face, and then went back to the Poom Executive Building, it was about 100 yards down the street, to ask for orders. By this time the roar of rifle and machine gun fire from various directions was almost comparable to the din of a battle. I had just found Cobb, and was asking him what we were supposed to do, when there was a series of appalling crashes down below. The din was so loud that I made sure someone must be firing at us with a field gun. Actually, it was only hand grenades, which double their usual noise when they burst among stone buildings. Cop glanced out of the window, cocked his stick behind his back, said, "Let us investigate," and strolled down the stairs in his usual unconcerned manner, I following. Just inside the doorway, a group of shock troopers were bowling bombs down the pavement as though playing skittles. The bombs were bursting 20 yards away with a frightful, ear-splitting crash, which was mixed up with the banging of rifles. Half across the street from behind the newspaper kiosk, a head, it was the head of an American militiaman whom I knew well, was sticking up for all the world like a coconut at a fair. It was only afterwards that I grasped what was really happening. Next door to the Poom building, there was a cafe with an hotel above it called the Cafe Mocha. The day before, 20 or 30 armed civil guards had entered the cafe, and then, when the fighting started, had suddenly seized the building and barricaded themselves in. Presumably they had been ordered to seize the cafe as a preliminary to attacking the Poom offices later. Early in the morning, they had attempted to come out, shots had been exchanged, and one shock trooper was badly wounded and a civil guard killed. The civil guards had fled back into the cafe, but when the American came down the street, they had opened fire on him, though he was not armed. The American had flung himself behind the kiosk for cover, and the shock troopers were flinging bombs at the civil guards to drive them indoors again. Cop took in the scene at a glance, pushed his way forward, and hauled back a red-haired German shock trooper who was just drawing the pin out of a bomb with his teeth. He shouted to everyone to stand back from the doorway and told us in several languages that we had got to avoid bloodshed. Then he stepped out onto the pavement and, in sight of the civil guards, ostentatiously took off his pistol and laid it on the ground. Two Spanish militia officers did the same, and the three of them walked slowly up to the doorway where the civil guards were huddling. It was a thing I wouldn't have done for £20. They were walking, unarmed, up to men who were frightened out of their wits and had loaded guns in their hands. A civil guard, in shirt sleeves and livid with fright, came out of the door to parley with Cop. He kept pointing in an agitated manner at two unexploded bombs that were lying on the pavement. Cop came back and told us we had better touch the bombs off. Lying there, they were a danger to anyone who passed. A shock trooper fired his rifle at one of the bombs and burst it, then fired at the other and missed. I asked him to give me his rifle, knelt down and let fly at the second bomb. I also missed it, I'm sorry to say. This was the only shot I fired during the disturbances. The pavement was covered with broken glass from the sign over the Cafe Mocha, and two cars that were parked outside, one of them Cop's official car, had been riddled with bullets and their windscreens smashed by bursting bombs. Cop took me upstairs again and explained the situation. We had got to defend the Poom buildings if they were attacked, but the Poom leaders had sent instructions that we were to stand on the defensive and not open fire if we could possibly avoid it. Immediately opposite, there was a cinematograph called the Poliorama, with a museum above it, and at the top, high above the general level of the roofs, a small observatory with twin domes. The domes commanded the street, and a few men posted up there with rifles could prevent any attack on the Poom buildings. The caretakers at the cinema were CNT members and would let us come and go. As for the civil guards in the Cafe Mocha, there would be no trouble with them. They didn't want to fight and would be only too glad to live and let live. Cop repeated that our orders were not to fire unless we were fired on ourselves or our buildings attacked. I gathered, though he did not say so, that the Poom leaders were furious at being dragged into this affair, but felt that they had got to stand by the CNT. They had already placed guards in the observatory. The next 3 days and nights I spent continuously on the roof of the Poliorama, except for brief intervals when I slipped across to the hotel for meals. I was in no danger. I suffered from nothing worse than hunger and boredom. Yet it was one of the most unbearable periods of my whole life. I think few experiences could be more sickening, more disillusioning, or finally more nerve-wracking than those evil days of street warfare. I used to sit on the roof, marvelling at the folly of it all. From the little windows in the observatory, you could see for miles around, vista after vista of tall, slender buildings, glass domes and fantastic curly roofs with brilliant green and copper tiles. Over to eastward, the glittering pale blue sea, the first glimpse of the sea that I had had since coming to Spain. And the whole huge town of 1 million people was locked in a sort of violent inertia, a nightmare of noise without movement. The sunlit streets were quite empty. Nothing was happening except the streaming of bullets from barricades and sandbag windows. Not a vehicle was stirring in the streets. Here and there along the Ramblas, the trams stood motionless where their drivers had jumped out of them when the fighting started. And all the while, the devilish noise, echoing from thousands of stone buildings, went on and on and on like a tropical rainstorm. Crack, crack, rattle, rattle, roar. Sometimes it died away to a few shots. Sometimes it quickened to a deafening fusillade. But it never stopped while daylight lasted, and punctually next dawn it started again. What the devil was happening, who was fighting whom and who was winning, was at first very difficult to discover. The people of Barcelona are so used to street fighting, and so familiar with the local geography, that they know by a kind of instinct which political party will hold which streets and which buildings. A foreigner is at a hopeless disadvantage. Looking out from the observatory, I could grasp that the Ramblas, which is one of the principal streets of the town, formed a dividing line. To the right of the Ramblas, the working-class quarters were solidly anarchist. To the left, a confused fight was going on among the tortuous by-streets. But on that side, the PSUC and the civil guards were more or less in control. Up at our end of the Ramblas, round the Plaza de Catalunya, the position was so complicated that it would have been quite unintelligible if every building had not flown a party flag. The principal landmark here was the Hotel Colón, the headquarters of the PSUC, dominating the Plaza de Catalunya. In a window near the last O but one in the huge Hotel Colón that sprawled across its face, they had a machine gun that could sweep the square with deadly effect. 100 yards to the right of us, down the Ramblas, the JSU, the Youth League of the PSUC, corresponding to the Young Communist League in England, were holding a big department store, whose sandbagged side windows fronted our observatory. They had hauled down their red flag and hoisted the Catalan national flag. On the telephone exchange, the starting point of all the trouble, the Catalan national flag and the anarchist flag were flying side by side. Some kind of temporary compromise had been arrived at there. The exchange was working uninterruptedly, and there was no firing from the building. In our position, it was strangely peaceful. The civil guards in the Café Mocha had drawn down the steel curtains and piled up the café furniture to make a barricade. Later, half a dozen of them came onto the roof, opposite to ourselves, and built another barricade of mattresses, over which they hung a Catalan national flag. But it was obvious that they had no wish to start a fight. COP had made a definite agreement with them. If they did not fire at us, we would not fire at them. He'd grown quite friendly with the civil guards by this time, and had been to visit them several times in the Café Mocha. Naturally, they had looted everything drinkable the café possessed, and they made COP a present of 15 bottles of beer. In return, COP had actually given them one of our rifles to make up for one they had somehow lost on the previous day. Nevertheless, it was a queer feeling sitting on that roof. Sometimes I was merely bored with the whole affair, paid no attention to the hellish noise, and spent hours reading a succession of Penguin Library books, which luckily I had bought a few days earlier. Sometimes I was very conscious of the armed men watching me 50 yards away. It was a little like being in the trenches again. Several times I caught myself from force of habit, speaking of the civil guards as the fascists. There were generally about 6 of us up there. We placed a man on guard in each of the observatory towers, and the rest of us sat on the lead roof below, where there was no cover except a stone palisade. I was well aware that at any moment the civil guards might receive telephone orders to open fire. They had agreed to give us warning before doing so, but there was no certainty that they would keep to their agreement. Only once, however, did trouble look like starting. One of the civil guards opposite knelt down and began firing across the barricade. I was on guard in the observatory at the time. I trained my rifle on him and shouted across, "Hi! Don't you shoot at us!" "What? Don't you fire at us, or we'll fire back!" "No, no, I wasn't firing at you. Look, down there!" He motioned with his rifle towards the side street that ran past the bottom of our building. Sure enough, a youth in blue overalls with a rifle in his hand was dodging round the corner. Evidently, he had just taken a shot at the civil guards on the roof. I was firing at him. He fired first. I believe this was true. "We don't want to shoot you. We're only workers, the same as you are." He made the anti-fascist salute, which I returned. I shouted across, "Have you got any more beer left?" "No, it's all gone." The same day, for no apparent reason, a man in the JSU building further down the street suddenly raised his rifle and let fly at me when I was leaning out of the window. Perhaps I made a tempting mark. I did not fire back. Though he was only 100 yards away, the bullet went so wide that it didn't even hit the roof of the observatory. As usual, Spanish standards of marksmanship had saved me. I was fired at several times from this building. The devilish racket of firing went on and on. But so far as I could see, and from all I heard, the fighting was defensive on both sides. People simply remained in their buildings, or behind their barricades, and blazed away at the people opposite. About half a mile away from us, there was a street where some of the main offices of the CNT and the UGT were almost exactly facing one another. From that direction, the volume of noise was terrific. I passed down that street the day after the fighting was over, and the panes of the shop windows were like sieves. Most of the shopkeepers in Barcelona had their windows crisscrossed with strips of paper, so that when a bullet hit a pane, it did not shiver to pieces. Sometimes the rattle of rifle and machine gun fire was punctuated by the crash of hand grenades, and at long intervals, perhaps a dozen times in all, there were tremendously heavy explosions, which at the time I could not account for. They sounded like aerial bombs, but that was impossible, for there were no aeroplanes about. I was told afterwards, quite possibly it was true, that Agents Provocateurs were touching off masses of explosive in order to increase the general noise and panic. There was, however, no artillery fire. I was listening for this, for if the guns began to fire, it would mean that the affair was becoming serious. Artillery is the determining factor in street warfare. Afterwards, there were wild tales in the newspapers about batteries of guns firing in the streets, but no one was able to point to a building that had been hit by a shell. In any case, the sound of gunfire is unmistakable if one is used to it. Almost from the start, food was running short. With difficulty and under cover of darkness, for the civil guards were constantly sniping into the Ramblas, food was brought from the Hotel Falcon for the 15 or 20 militiamen who were in the PUM executive building. But there was barely enough to go round, and as many of us as possible went to the Hotel Continental for our meals. The Continental had been collectivised by the Generalité, and not, like most of the hotels, by the CNT or UGT, and it was regarded as neutral ground. No sooner had the fighting started than the hotel filled the brim with the most extraordinary collection of people. There were foreign journalists, political suspects of every shade, an American airman in the service of the government, various communist agents, including a fat, sinister-looking Russian, said to be an agent of the Ogpu, who was nicknamed Charlie Chan, and wore, attached to his waistband, a revolver and a neat little bomb, some families of well-to-do Spaniards who looked like fascist sympathisers, two or three wounded men from the International Column, a gang of lorry drivers from some huge French lorries which had been carrying a load of oranges back to France and had been held up by the fighting, and a number of popular army officers. The popular army, as a body, remained neutral throughout the fighting, though a few soldiers slipped away from the barracks and took part as individuals. On the Tuesday morning, I had seen a couple of them at the PUM barricades. At the beginning, before the food shortage became acute and the newspapers began stirring up hatred, there was a tendency to regard the whole affair as a joke. This was the kind of thing that happened every year in Barcelona, people were saying. George Tioli, an Italian journalist, a great friend of ours, came in with his trousers drenched with blood. He had gone out to see what was happening and had been binding up a wounded man on the pavement when someone playfully tossed a hand grenade at him, fortunately not wounding him seriously. I remember his remarking that the Barcelona paving stones ought to be numbered. It would save such a lot of trouble in building and demolishing barricades. And I remember a couple of men from the International Column sitting in my room at the hotel when I came in, tired, hungry and dirty, after a night on guard. Their attitude was completely neutral. If they had been good party men, they would, I suppose, have urged me to change sides, or even have pinioned me and taken away the bombs of which my pockets were full. Instead, they merely commiserated with me for having to spend my leave in doing guard duty on a roof. The general attitude was, this is only a dust-up between the anarchists and the police. It doesn't mean anything. In spite of the extent of the fighting and the number of casualties, I believe this was nearer the truth than the official version, which represented the affair as a planned rising. It was about Wednesday, the 5th of May, that a change seemed to come over things. The shuttered streets looked ghastly. A very few pedestrians, forced abroad for one reason or another, crept to and fro, flourishing white handkerchiefs. And at a spot in the middle of the Ramblas that was safe from bullets, some men were crying newspapers to the empty streets. On Tuesday, Solidaridad Obrera, the anarchist paper, had described the attack on the telephone exchange as a monstrous provocation, or words to that effect. But on Wednesday, it changed its tune and began imploring everyone to go back to work. The anarchist leaders were broadcasting the same message. The office of La Batalla, the Poom paper, which was not defended, had been raided and seized by the civil guards at about the same time as the telephone exchange. But the paper was being printed and a few copies distributed from another address. It urged everyone to remain at the barricades. People were divided in their minds and wondering uneasily how the devil this was going to end. I doubt whether anyone left the barricades as yet, but everyone was sick of the meaningless fighting, which could obviously lead to no real decision, because no one wanted this to develop into a full-sized civil war, which might mean losing the war against Franco. I heard this fear expressed on all sides. So far as one could gather from what people were saying at the time, the CNT rank and file wanted, and had wanted from the beginning, only two things: the handing back of the telephone exchange and the disarming of the hated civil guards. If the Generalité had promised to do these two things, and also promised to put an end to the food profiteering, there is little doubt that the barricades would have been down in 2 hours. But it was obvious that the Generalité was not going to give in. Ugly rumours were flying round. It was said that the Valencia government was sending 6,000 men to occupy Barcelona, and that 5,000 anarchist and Poom troops had left the Aragon front to oppose them. Only the first of these rumours was true. Watching from the observatory tower, we saw the low grey shapes of warships closing in upon the harbour. Douglas Moyle, who had been a sailor, said that they looked like British destroyers. As a matter of fact, they were British destroyers, though we did not learn this till afterwards. That evening, we heard that on the Plaza de España, 400 civil guards had surrendered and handed their arms to the anarchists. Also, the news was vaguely filtering through that in the suburbs, mainly working-class quarters, the CNT were in control. It looked as though we were winning. But the same evening, cops sent for me and with a grave face told me that, according to information he had just received, the government was about to outlaw the Poom and declare a state of war upon it. The news gave me a shock. It was the first glimpse I had had of the interpretation that was likely to be put upon this affair later on. I dimly foresaw that when the fighting ended, the entire blame would be laid upon the Poom, which was the weakest party and therefore the most suitable scapegoat, and meanwhile our local neutrality was at an end. If the government declared war upon us, we had no choice but to defend ourselves, and here at the executive building we could be certain that the civil guards next door would get orders to attack us. Our only chance was to attack them first. Cop was waiting for orders on the telephone. If we heard definitely that the Poom was outlawed, we must make preparations at once to seize the Café Mocha. I remember the long, nightmarish evening that we spent in fortifying the building. We locked the steel curtains across the front entrance, and behind them built a barricade of slabs of stone left behind by the workmen who had been making some alterations. We went over our stock of weapons. Counting the 6 rifles that were on the roof of the Poliorama opposite, we had 21 rifles, one of them defective, about 50 rounds of ammunition for each rifle, and a few dozen bombs, otherwise nothing except a few pistols and revolvers. About a dozen men, mostly Germans, had volunteered for the attack on the Café Mocha if it came off. We should attack from the roof, of course, sometime in the small hours, and take them by surprise. They were more numerous, but our morale was better, and no doubt we could storm the place, though people were bound to be killed in doing so. We had no food in the building except a few slabs of chocolate, and the rumour had gone round that they were going to cut off the water supply. Nobody knew who they were. It might be the government that controlled the waterworks, or it might be the CNT. Nobody knew. We spent a long time filling up every basin in the lavatories, every bucket we could lay hands on, and finally the 15 beer bottles, now empty, which the civil guards had given to Cop. I was in a ghastly frame of mind and dog-tired after about 60 hours without much sleep. It was now late into the night. People were sleeping all over the floor behind the barricade downstairs. Upstairs there was a small room with a sofa in it, which we intended to use as a dressing station, though, needless to say, we discovered that there was neither iodine nor bandages in the building. My wife had come down from the hotel in case a nurse should be needed. I lay down on the sofa, feeling that I would like half an hour's rest before the attack on the Mocha, in which I should presumably be killed. I remember the intolerable discomfort caused by my pistol, which was strapped to my belt and sticking into the small of my back. And the next thing I remember is waking up with a jerk to find my wife standing beside me. It was broad daylight. Nothing had happened. The government had not declared war on the Poom. The water had not been cut off. And except for the sporadic firing in the streets, everything was normal. My wife said that she had not had the heart to wake me and had slept in an armchair in one of the front rooms. That afternoon there was a kind of armistice. The firing died away, and with surprising suddenness the streets filled with people. A few shops began to pull up their shutters, and the market was packed with a huge crowd clamouring for food, though the stalls were almost empty. It was noticeable, however, that the trains did not start running. The civil guards were still behind their barricades in the Mocha. On neither side were the fortified buildings evacuated. Everyone was rushing round and trying to buy food, and on every side you heard the same anxious questions. Do you think it's stopped? Do you think it's going to start again? It, the fighting, was now thought of as some kind of natural calamity, like a hurricane or an earthquake, which was happening to us all alike and which we had no power of stopping. And sure enough, almost immediately, I suppose there must really have been several hours' truce, but they seemed more like minutes than hours, a sudden crash of rifle fire like a June cloudburst sent everyone scurrying. The steel shutters snapped into place, the streets emptied like magic, the barricades were manned, and it had started again. I went back to my post on the roof with a feeling of concentrated disgust and fury. When you are taking part in events like these, you are, I suppose, in a small way making history, and you ought by rights to feel like an historical character. But you never do, because at such times the physical details always outweigh everything else. Throughout the fighting, I never made the correct analysis of the situation that was so glibly made by journalists hundreds of miles away. What I was chiefly thinking about was not the rights and wrongs of this miserable internecine scrap, but simply the discomfort and boredom of sitting day and night on that intolerable roof, and the hunger, which was growing worse and worse, for none of us had had a proper meal since Monday.